Well, good evening, everyone. This is Larry Stoller, and I am delighted to welcome you all. I know there are numbers of you listening live right now, and some of you will be listening later to the recording of this amazing call we're going to have tonight. I am part of the team that helps to promote and spread the message that we have at the Traditional Chinese Medicine World Foundation. And in particular, I'm excited to be part of the team that helps to organize and put on our annual conference, which happens this fall. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker tonight, Lillian Bridges. What I can say about Lillian is that she has an amazing story, and she can tell you about that in a moment. But the part that's so wonderful about her story is that she has come upon an ancient practice in Chinese medicine and in Chinese life of facial reading and facial diagnosis. And over the many years that she's been involved with this, from her early years as a child in a family with people with these gifts, she has succeeded to bring a broad awareness of the benefits of this way of approaching, its value, and how helpful it can be to understanding our clients, if we're practitioners, and ourselves, which is everyone. So I'm going to jump right in and welcome Lillian. Lillian, good evening.
Hi. Thanks for
having me. Good, good. I'm glad you're made the connection. And we're pretty ready to go. How are you tonight?
I'm good, thank you.
Good, wonderful. So we have we're thinking about this this webinar, this conversation, as being focused on journey back to your original face. And so that's what we're mostly going to be talking about. And I wondered if you could start, based on what I said in my introduction, about something about your personal journey, how you found yourself getting involved in facial reading and then later facial diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, I actually come from an interesting Chinese family. My mother is Chinese, and her mother comes from a long line of face readers. And so I was very privileged to have her as a grandmother. I loved her very much. And she read everybody's face. And it was passed down to her from her father, even though she was a girl, which wasn't usual, because she was his favorite child. So she learned from a young age about face reading, and she had no problem teaching me. Actually, all of her children knew something about face reading, but I was the one who sat there and kept asking her lots and lots of questions from a very early age, from five, actually, about four and a half, actually, all the way until she died. And I learned everything that I possibly could and asked a lot of questions.
You told me, I think we were talking before the call, that are you still there?
I'm here, thanks.
Did you finish? I couldn't tell. Maybe you got this. You started at five and a half, right?
Actually, four and a half. And you know, it's really the ancient apprenticeship method, because, you know, I watched and learned and asked and watched and learned and asked. And, you know, at some point I was allowed to have some input, but it was really the old ancient way of learning.
Yes. So what happened then? I mean, you went on in your life, and I don't know if you ever expected this would be, you know, become such a big part of your professional life.
It was not the plan. I think it's very karmic, actually, if you believe in karma. No, what happened was, it's kind of a funny story, I actually had wanted to be a writer most of my life, and I was actually in school to study writing. And I was engaged, almost engaged. I wasn't engaged yet. I had to run my ex-husband by the family gauntlet, which was very intimidating. And when he met my uncle, he actually shook my uncle's hand, and my uncle opened the front door. And my uncle stared at him and said, "You almost died when you were 25. What happened? Were you sick or was it an accident?" He said, "No, you were sick. It was a long time. You were very sick." He said, "Oh, I'm glad you're well." His mouth just dropped open. He said, "What is this?" I said, "Oh, it's Chinese face reading." He said, "Can you do this?" I go, "Oh, yeah, you know, like, no big deal." And as the day proceeded, he got read by everybody, mostly in Chinese, I might add. And they were very accurate. I did get the, you know, the seal of approval. But he was so shocked that he was driving home with me, and he was a very left-brain kind of engineer. He said, "You need to write a book on this." And that was the day I started writing. I decided that it was something that needed to be written, and so I started. I haven't really realized that it was different. My family just does it. Although, that being said, none of my cousins really reads faces at all.
It was something really for you.
Yeah, it was very unusual, and you know, part of the reason why too, I was born at a time when it wasn't okay for couples of different races to be married, and my mother got in trouble from her father for marrying, you know, an American man, and my father, you know, from the South was told it wasn't okay to marry a Chinese woman, and my grandmother actually, you know, defied everyone and said, I'm going to go see my granddaughter, and I have a picture of her staring down at me as a newborn. And I'm looking up at her with this look that says, I'm yours, you know. And I think it was a very special bond. I'm very grateful to have had her and have her teach me this amazing knowledge and wisdom from the past.
So you began to realize that your writing project was going to be your own book. I have a feeling you didn't know what the book was going to be about.
No, it took me a really long time to write the book because the way the Chinese teach is actually in a circular manner. And also, too, my grandmother was such an expert that she would actually pull up these three or four different features and together would give, you know, an analysis of them. And I didn't know what meant what. And I never learned the details. And so it took me 23 years to actually pull apart all the details of the information to get it into a form that Westerners could actually use to learn it. It was very complicated for me, actually, to pull it apart because I learned it in a different way. The Asian way is to kind of absorb it and to kind of, you know, learn it all at once, you know, over time.
Exactly. Well said. You know, I think that this is, for me, one of the most amazing parts of our life and this time. I mean, you're actually living it. You've said already you live it because you're bridging. You personally are bridging East and West.
Yeah.
And everyone who's listening to this call and everyone who's interested, who lives in the United States at least, I mean, people could be listening beyond us, maybe even in Asia listening, I suppose. But most of us are Westerners. And we're all bridging this gap, and which means somehow we have we're interested in experiencing the Chinese way, which you're saying is, you know, circular, and we have to process it in our Western mind, which is more linear, let's say.
Right.
And you've been able to do that.
I guess that's a blessing in being half Chinese and half, you know, Caucasian. I mean, I certainly do carry both traits from both cultures, and I certainly was raised with both cultures. And, you know, I think the interesting thing that I deal with is that a lot of people, you know, obviously question this Chinese knowledge, but in reality, it was an observational science that was done for thousands of years. And so it's got a lot of legitimacy in terms of, you know, what can be seen.
Yeah, could you say more about that? I think that would be really interesting. It's interesting to me, but I think also to the listeners to get a better sense of what you're really talking about when you talk about face reading or then facial diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, I actually really enjoy facial diagnosis, but it was also used for a couple of other things. It was used for matchmaking, for one, which I don't do very much of, by the way. It was also used for business. You know, it was used for, obviously, medicine. And it was, you know, a very interesting thing to really get into the medical part of it, because it's quite easy to use as a diagnostic tool. And in reality, when I teach medical doctors, which I do primarily in Europe and some here in the U.S. as well, they're always saying, oh, yeah, I learned that in medical school. Oh yeah, that's right. That's something that we know about. And things like, you know, when someone has kidney disease, their eye socket gets very dark and shadowed, showing that the kidneys aren't functioning well. And it's very understandable for Western medical doctors to realize that that area shows the kidneys because they also look at that. Or to see anemia, you know, it definitely can be seen as, you know, paleness of the skin and the tongue and all that. So in reality, it's not very dissimilar. And if you know the subtleties of it, there's details on the face that correspond to certain organs that show you how the organ's functioning. And so, for example, with Western medicine, one of the arguments that I use a lot is that we all know that if you have a liver problem and you get jaundice, then you're going to see it in the whites of the eyes. Well, the Chinese have always said that sclera is a place to look for liver function. I mean, current liver function is shown right there in the color of the whites. And you can actually monitor that, you know, very easily, and also see signs of liver problems long before a blood test will show the liver's compromised. So you can actually do a lot of preventative things with facial diagnosis, which I think is really cool.
So then it fits, I mean, this is the model of Chinese medicine in the end, right?
Right.
I mean, that there's all these preventative options because you see things before they
right.
manifest in a deeper way.
Yeah, and before they become a really big problem. And I think that, you know, one of the things that most people in Chinese medicine learn about is the Neijing and the Yellow Emperor's Classic. And in there they talk about the different colors in the face, which are very valuable for diagnosis. And you can actually see, you know, how each organ is doing based on the colors that show up there. It's actually quite easy to do, I might add. It's just becoming aware of it.
Yeah, so I'm still interested, very interested in your journey. So mm-hmm. you found yourself more or able to speak to some of the diagnostic and medical uses of facial diagnosis then, right?
Well,
but
yeah,
you didn't start there.
No, that's kind of a funny story, actually. I started reading faces. I thought, well, okay, if I'm going to write a book, I better start practicing it. So I started seeing clients, which I thought was actually really scary, but it was ends up being quite fun. You know, in helping individual people, and then I was taking a class, this is actually a very true story, I was taking a class at UCLA, and it was about writing a nonfiction, you know, book, and I'd heard from an instructor who said something like, you know, you've got to make yourself an expert in the eyes of a publisher, so I walked up to him after class and said, you know, I don't know that I'm really an expert. He says, well, what do you do? And I told him, he goes, well, how long have you been doing it? I said, so it was 4 and a half, and he said, oh, my gosh, if you're not an expert, nobody is. Go out and teach a class. Then you'll realize what you know. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, okay. And I really am not as bold as I sound. I do travel a lot and teach, but people ask me. I don't actually try to ask for jobs. So I called a bookstore in the town that I was living in, and I called up and said, look, I'm writing a book on Chinese face reading. I'd like to teach a class. They go, oh, that sounds so cool. We have a cancellation in 2 weeks. Can you teach a class? I go, oh, yeah, sure. So I showed up, and I taught a class. And what was astonishing to me, and I taught mostly about personality, by the way, is how well-received it was. And I got invited back and invited back again. It kept going. And next thing I know, I thought, you know, I would like to teach at junior college. And a woman came to the class, and she was actually from a junior college, and she was, you know, doing continuing education work there. And she said, oh, come to the school and teach. And next thing you know, I was teaching at all these junior colleges. And then one day I said, you know, I'd like to teach people in Chinese medicine because I know about Chinese medicine. And my then husband told me I was kind of crazy because I wasn't an acupuncturist, and I'm not an acupuncturist. But I ended up teaching a class at a junior college where one of the students was the head of the students at Samar University. And she walked up to me and said, would you give a free talk to the students? I said, oh, yeah, sure. So I go and teach Samara. The dean walks by. She comes in and she goes, oh, this is really cool. And she stayed. And then she said, would you like to teach a class? And I got hired to be a faculty member and teach facial diagnosis. So that's how it started. I literally just found my way into Chinese medicine.
Right. I mean, that's what you meant when you said with your grandmother that it's like a karmic thing. There's the,
your
doors kept being open for you.
Yeah, and then I started teaching at symposiums and conferences around the world as I teach more and more acupuncture schools. So, yeah, I teach a lot of acupuncture students and also doctors and nurses and chiropractors and whatever, but also the general public and business people use face reading.
Mm-hmm. So can you say more about how, like, say, if you're speaking to acupuncturists, what you want them to appreciate about the value of face reading and diagnosis? You started to say a few examples, but can you say more? Like, what do you think that acupuncturists could really gain by knowing this more?
That's a big question because the face, in my opinion, shows just about everything. And mm-hmm. so I personally like to teach a lot about how much it shows the jing, which is the constitutional aspect of the body, and how it's being managed, as well as the shen, which is the spirit part of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can certainly read all the qi markers and see how the organs are doing, which I mentioned before, but I just think there's a huge wealth of information, and my personal interest is a little unusual in that I love the psychological and emotional underlay disease, so I really focus a lot on how you can read someone's nature and how they're acting and behaving and living in ways that are maybe contrary to that or in ways that are damaging to that, and what you can do to help people, you know, get back on track. And so I spend a lot of time working with people's traumas, for example. The face has a number of maps, which I think are really interesting. One in particular is a map of age positions. And it shows whenever something traumatic, good stress or bad stress, marks the face. And, you know, when I've had pushback from people about that, I actually show them a tree ring and say, look, they can see, dendrologists can see, in this year, you know, there was fire, in this year there was lack of water, in this year they had a lot of nutrients and a lot of sunshine, and, you know, it's really wide. And the human body is really no different. We show exactly how old we were when something happened. We don't show what happened exactly. We show when exactly it happened. And so I work with people a lot and teach my students to actually read people's trauma map. Mm-hmm. Because that helps them understand, you know, what kinds of things are blocked and why they're blocked. So I see a lot of value in the psychological underlay that the facial map shows.
I love the tree analogy. I think that's something everybody can relate to because we've all seen that, you know.
Yeah, that was actually self-defense. People go, I don't understand why we can mark the face. I said, well, trees mark, you know. So, and there's also a map of emotions. So all the emotions that you felt, which basically is the wrinkles, they're all previously felt or held emotions. And so all the emotions that you are not releasing show up, and those also can be very diagnostically helpful.
Mm-hmm. So can you give us an example of, let's say, on a there's been some kind of significant ill, you gave an example, you know, of your ex-husband, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. somebody who had some significant event and you're looking at trauma markers in the person's face, like what would be an example of one thing you might look for, not look for, but you might see when you meet somebody that would tell you, oh, here's something that happened to somebody when they were, you know, in their...
Well, yeah, I tend to work backwards. So if someone comes to me and they have a major health concern, I do try to look and see if I can find trauma underneath it. And I actually don't go looking for trauma. If they don't know they have it, I'm not going to, you know, tell them.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, I do work with a number of cancer patients, and one of the things that I have found in hundreds and hundreds of cancer patients is a toxified trauma, a trauma that's become in some way unresolvable. And when they find that and they go and do some work with it, and I don't do the work, I send them to psychologists, you know, I send them to therapists. When they do some work on that, it does seem to help the body, you know, in a way, because, I mean, to give you an example, grief has been very much shown to inhibit immune function. This is actually Western medicine, and there's lots of studies that show that. And people mm-hmm. can carry grief for a really long time. And when you do, you know, therapeutic work to release grief, the immune system bounces back. So right there, you're making a difference. And grief lines are so easy to see. They're all the lines that are on the cheek from underneath the eye down into that whole cheek area. So whenever you have mm-hmm. lines there, you've got some kind of grief. And there's three or four different kinds that I look for.
Uh-huh.
They're really valuable stuff to let go of grief.
So what you're saying is you start with basically like any practitioner, there's a presenting problem.
Yeah.
And then you want to – yeah, go ahead.
You know, no, but the thing is, though, I don't look to see, you know, why they're sick. I don't think disease is a punishment, by the way. I think it's just one of the things happen, obviously. But there may be some causative factors that you have some control over, and I think the emotional, psychological component of that can definitely be worked with to free up some of the energy.
Right, and so you also said that you feel like your best service is to help people identify things that they might not recognize that might have been hidden to them.
Right.
But you can make it available, and then they can choose to work on it in different ways.
Right. Well, I also identify their personality traits. So I think sometimes they don't know either, you know. So that's the whole point of the original face. And, you know, the ancient Taoist concept of the original face is that you have this kind of soul level or spirit level self, you know, that you come in with, and that your body is, you know, meant to manifest that through. And very often the personality traits that we have, and even the talents and abilities we have, or, you know, the body that we were given, are all things that are supposed to work with that kind of spirit part of the self. Mm-hmm. And the original face is something you're supposed to go back to because that's who you really are. And that the whole point of enlightenment is to become your most authentic self. And so I think one of my happiest days in working on my book years ago was finding the original symbol of the word Tao in a pictogram, the most ancient pictograph I could find.
Mm-hmm.
And in that pictogram, my pictograph, it actually showed a face. It showed eyes, nose, and a mouth, and hair standing straight up, meaning you're connected to the heavens, the cosmos. And then it showed the symbol of like someone running. So it actually showed a foot on this path. And the translation is exactly a face running on a path. So that once you know who you really are, you can actually do your meaning, which is your mandate from heaven, you know, in this plane of existence. And so I got so excited, and I realized that one of my goals was to help people understand who they really are. So I do a lot of work with personality, which can be very healing because a lot of us play roles or we, you know, we act in ways that we think are dutiful or, you know, necessary in life, but they actually may be opposed to our soul's urgings, you know, our soul's nature. So I work a lot with personality.
That's so interesting. I want you to say more about that if you would. But at first, I want to say I think I saw that symbol on your website.
Yeah, it's everywhere I could possibly put it. It's so cool.
We should tell people about your website. So it's say what the web address is.
Yeah, it's www.lotusinstitute.com, and Lotus is actually my Chinese name. My Chinese name is Li Lei Liang, which is independent lotus blossom. So that's why it's called that. Yeah.
So people can go to your website and they can learn a lot more about you, but also that ancient symbol is there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so people can see the example
you
can
get. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll often say that Nike has their symbol backwards because the Chinese symbol for running is the other way.
Say that again, the Chinese symbol?
The Chinese symbol for running is actually the opposite of the Nike one. It goes the other direction, but it's very similar.
Just do it, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So how do you see the original face in someone's face? How do you start to become more sensitive to notice that?
Well, here's the thing about facing that I think is quite wonderful, and that is, you know, you can definitely look at clues in the face and find all kinds of, you know, bits and pieces of information. The most important part of face reading and what I teach my students is to integrate those things and create a kind of a profile of someone, not from a judgmental point of view at all, but from, you know, what you discern from them. And I guess the hardest thing to understand for most people when I talk about this is that there are so many traits that we actually carry. This is epigenetics. And we actually don't use all of the traits that we have and that we can actually go in and turn switches on. And frankly, we can morph very easily. People don't understand that morphing is part of what we do. And I have actually seen, and I've taken lots of photographs of my students doing face readings, where someone's face will change in an hour consultation. And that's because they're morphing based on the fact that they're presenting something more or different that they have inside. So technically, I don't believe that a face changes. I think you can grow, but I also think you can go back and find new stuff, you know. And so the face is very malleable. And I, you know, wrinkles can go away. I've lost most of my wrinkles on my face. They come back now and then for, you know, different ones. But I let them go again, too. And therefore, we're not set in any way. And there's numbers of studies that actually talk about this, even babies looking more like, you know, the man who's there, especially the father. So the face is actually something that is very easy to alter, and therefore what you're looking for is what is someone presenting. And, you know, on some level, when you're working with someone, you can actually feel a lot about who they are. And are they showing who they are? And do they have traits that are kind of intrinsic that they're manifesting? I mean, to give you an example, I have a client who has really big eyebrows. And big eyebrows are quite a gift in the Western world because they mean that your liver is very strong. And you have the ability to be athletic and to work hard and to drink alcohol if you want to. You know, I mean, all kinds of great things come from liver chi. But she was acting like a very helpless, passive, kind of, I don't know what the word is exactly, but someone who wasn't in her power, and her liver clearly shows that she has a certain kind of power that she wasn't manifesting. And I kept saying to her, I'm really not sure why you're not acting this way, but you're a powerful woman. And I kept talking to her about it, and things would come out about her childhood when she was really athletic or when she ran for student body president. And it was very fascinating to see why she'd repressed that so much. And a lot of health conditions actually improved as she moved into that manifestation of liberty. So I like things like that. I like to help people become more of who they're supposed to be.
This is the thing that I find really interesting listening to you is the sense you're giving of the interaction that happens between you and the person you're working with.
Yeah.
Right? Like there's
yeah,
So when you're attending to somebody's face, uh-huh. I'm getting from this that this is pretty intimate. You know, like
oh, yeah.
Our face is intimate, and
very much
to
so.
look carefully at someone's face is an intimate act, and the
very
connection
so.
That can happen, you uh-huh. know, with someone as sensitive as you are,
uh-huh.
can help people feel seen.
Yes, and
in
that
a way that we're all yearning to be seen.
Yeah. And to me, that's what I teach my students is it's a privilege if someone lets you in, you know, lets you see their true nature. And it's a very sacred thing to me, actually. And it's one of those things where I teach all my students that, you know, there's no place for judgment whatsoever. I mean, traits are just traits, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Someone can have a stubborn chin, and sometimes it's really useful, and sometimes it's not so useful, you know. It doesn't matter that it's a stubborn chin. It just means that you have the capability of being stubborn if you need to. And so I'm not going to look at that and say, oh, that's good or bad, because there's no place for judgment in face reading, in my opinion. You know, it's like
mm-hmm.
they're just traits, you know. And that intimacy, I think, is really a powerful thing because, as you say, is people do want to be seen. And when they're seen and appreciated, because I really work from that point of view, my grandmother taught me that way, to appreciate people, it's a very healing act. And, you know, one of the things that I don't teach people is how to be intuitive, and luckily all my students are intuitive. I think most people can be intuitive. And that's, for me, one of the most important things about diagnosis, even with, you know, medical doctors who are working with what looks like scientific data, and it is, you know, useful information from a blood test or whatever else, they still have to synthesize it. And synthesizing something always involves intuition. So I think face reading is a really cool thing to learn because it actually increases your intuition. It's a kind of a tool through which intuition can be used. But I also think it really enhances nonverbal communication as well as emotional intelligence. So I think face reading's cool.
That's a lot of things.
it's really cool.
Huge benefits.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I think Daniel Goleman in his book Emotional Intelligence mentioned reading expressions about, I don't know, 100 times. I kept going, yes, yes, you know. It's very helpful.
So can you give other examples of things you've seen along the way that maybe surprised you that you were able to discover through you know, a session with somebody reading, doing facial diagnosis or face reading?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I'm absolutely fascinated by people, and this is why I studied psychology earlier on. I think people are so interesting, like why people do what they do or how they respond to the, you know, what happens and what they think about things later. And one of the things I was going to mention in terms of trauma, it's, and I'm sure you know this being a psychologist yourself, is often people have a worldview that's based on how old they were at the time the trauma happened.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And often they don't get to a place where they can look at it from now. And I actually use this a lot when I'm working with someone. If I find something, like this, for example, I had a client one time who hadn't moved house since she got married, and she lived in this house for probably 30 years. And her husband wanted to retire and move away, and she was freaking out, I mean, literally freaking out. And I said to her, why are you so afraid to move? Oh, I have all my friends and my grocery store. I mean, all legitimate reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, well, it sounds like there's a stronger reaction here than I would expect. Could you have two homes? Could you have this one, another home? Anyway, we kept talking because she was literally terrified of the idea of moving away. And it turned out, of course, that she was a military child. child of a military father, mm-hmm. and moved all the time when she was young. And that whole idea of moving and starting over was so terrifying to her that once she found a place to root, she never wanted to leave again. You know, and she realized after we talked that, you know, all these markers on her ears and then her forehead, all the way through her teen years until she'd go to college, were stress markings from saying, oh, I've got to move every couple of years. You know, whereas someone else will have the same kind of childhood and love to travel and love to move, you know. So it doesn't matter what happens to you. It matters how you feel about what happens to you. And it was really...
And maybe how you process it.
Yeah, how you process it, how you store it, too, and, like, where you store it. And this is one of those things where when I discover someone's underlay, when I find those traumas that present underneath a certain illness, you never know what trauma is going to go where, you know, what organ is going to take it. You know, I'll just give you an example. This is a kind of a personal one, but I'll just give it to you. I had a lot of trouble with IBS for years, and I didn't realize that I thought that I had a faulty colon, frankly. I did all kinds of work on that organ, and nothing really seemed to help. And I tried all kinds of diets, and I tried acupuncture, and I mean all kinds of cleanses. I mean anything you can imagine. And I don't really know how it happened, but I realized that I was storing anger in my colon. And here's what was interesting: is I didn't think I had a temper. When I was young, my mother was a temperamental woman, and she was good at getting mad. Nobody else in the family could get mad, so I thought I didn't have a temper at all until I had my younger son, who challenged me a lot in very good ways. So I realized I had a temper, and I realized that I need to use it and use it well. I mean, you know, learn how to manage it. But I still had spent many years repressing anger whenever I felt it, and I'm not even sure what happened, but I realized that I didn't have a problem with my colon, I had a problem with my liver, because I was repressing anger before I even felt it. If I had the first inklings of anger come up, I'd repress it. It was actually getting stored, apparently, in my intestines. And so I, of course, did some therapy and worked with that and learned how to express anger, you know, faster, you know, sooner, I mean, smaller in all kinds of ways. And my colon cleared up. And so there's this really interesting thing about where we store emotions, and that I'd actually, in Chinese medicine, my liver's not very strong. I have really small eyebrows. And so apparently my lung system, you know, and my intestines are very, very strong. Mm-hmm. So rather than having a faulty colon, I actually had a very strong colon that was actually storing emotions it wasn't supposed to store. So now I have pretty healthy intestines because I manage my anger well. I'm still not very angry, but when I get angry, I know how to deal with it well.
So did this, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that you're, you know, mm-hmm. telling something about yourself.
Yeah, well, that's fine. We all have our stuff, you know.
We do, and I appreciate that.
Well, the thing that's interesting is if you look at my face, my liver is not strong. My lungs and my large intestine are very strong.
Where do you see that? Where do you see the lung and large intestine?
Well, so my liver is, all the sides for liver are not big. I especially my eyebrows are not big at all. In fact, they're really soft and they're kind of small. And trust me, I cannot drink very much. I got the Chinese liver, not the German one. So my liver is not strong, but my nose is strong. My cheekbones are strong. My cheeks are good. And all the areas that show intestines are also very good. So I was presenting with an organ being problematic that wasn't. And until I figured out what organ was problematic, I actually couldn't get that to work. And now, of course, I have figured it out, and so I work on my liver a lot. I do a lot of liver cleanses. You know, I work on how to express anger in the best way possible. I mean, one of the things that I do, which is kind of ridiculous, I guess, both in a way, is if I get really mad, I'll write someone an email, and I make sure I don't put their email address on top. I'll write this whole long email, and then I usually won't send it. Something, and then I get over it and I talk to them about it.
I really think the world would be a kinder place if more people did that.
Yeah, I just want to like release what I'm feeling. Then I read it and kind of go, oh, that's not really.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe it doesn't really need to be said. There's something another way to say this. But in the meantime, you at least got it out, right?
Yeah, and it really helps me. But I don't send it. I do not send it. But that's one of the tricks. I have lots of tricks for working with that. Because I discovered I have a very hot temper, actually. It doesn't last very long. And apparently my kids have told me, they're grown, but they've told me I'm not very scary when I'm mad. So I just, you know, I'm like a match, you know. But for so long, I didn't think I had that.
Yeah. One of the things I think you're demonstrating that is lovely, it must be, I mean, it's about you, you know, but it's lovely is that your curiosity and openness guides you to continue to learn about yourself or whatever you need to learn. And, you know, I'm saying this partly as a way to make a bridge to to something else, which is, you know, about like self-discovery. Mm-hmm. So our conference in the fall, as you know, the title of the conference is Consciousness, Self-Discovery, and Everyday Health. So the focus on self-discovery, how important that is for all of us, is something we really want to emphasize. And you've spoken about it here in yourself. Mm-hmm. And then you also said in the work you do with people, you offer them a new way of thinking about themselves and mm-hmm. a path into themselves mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. they didn't see.
Yeah, I people are fascinating. I really love people, I have to say, honestly, and I just want to know about them. I'm so curious about their stories and their lives and how they've managed. I mean, I'm always astonished at how psychologically healthy most people actually are, considering what they go through. And mm-hmm. people should give them a lot more credit for, you know, surviving some pretty hard times and you know, developing some strength from it as well. So I almost always try to reward people for their passage, you know, through life. And I think that the way that I work with face reading that has to do with self-discovery is that there's a very great saying from, you know, the Tao Te Ching from Lao Tzu, and it says that to know other people is to become wise, and to know yourself is to become enlightened. And this is where I think that the most important thing we can do is learn about who we are. And, you know, as a psychologist, you know this too, but so many people project of who they are and other people. And if they didn't do projection, the world would be a lot better place. And so I think we have to kind of own who we are, you know, shadow and all. And I think face reading is a really wonderful tool for understanding who we are and accepting ourselves, you know. And so I think that people need to know what's good about them. And that's what face reading, I think, is really useful. Now, mind you, Chinese face reading could also have been used as a judgmental way, and it was. My grandmother in particular, though, thought that it was much kinder and wiser to be kind to people. And I've taken it a bit further and made things probably more positive than even she did.
And I think even really than helpful. She did?
Yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. I think everybody knows what's wrong with themselves mostly. A few exceptions, I suppose. But, but, you know, I think people need to know what's right about them. And I try to focus on positives a lot. And people will actually say to me, Lillian, tell me what's wrong with me. And I'll go, you know that. You know what's wrong with you. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm going to tell you what's right about you. I want you to focus on that. And I really will actually focus on what's really good about people. In fact, I've been known to look at someone and go, oh, that's an amazing nose. They go, I hate my nose. I go, oh, it's great. You know, tell them why. And they go, really? I go, yeah, it's great, and here's why, and I'll give them all the reasons, and I go, oh, I like it better now, and I really mean that. I look at these traits and go, oh, that's so cool, because it is to me. It's like, wow, that's amazing.
Well, I could just see how, you know, when people work with you, how powerful that is. To
I really mean it, though, too.
I know you do. That's exactly what I meant by saying it, that, yeah. You know, that you really bring this deep respect and love of this person that you're seeing, and you want them to see that too.
Well, I think acceptance, you know, acceptance of self, acceptance of others is something that we just don't do enough of. And I think with face reading, it really helps people recognize their innate nature, and I think that's really helpful. I remember at one point, this is my son, of course, being raised by a mother who reads faces, said to me something like, well, Mom, who do you think I got it from? I have the same nose as you. Mm-hmm. it was kind of cute, but he was right, you know. It's like, okay, yeah. But he's also very willing to say, you know, who he is too. Like, well, yeah, I'm that way, and kind of own his own traits. And I think this is something that's really important. And as a younger woman, I have to tell you, it was face reading was very valuable because I was told I was certain things. For example, in relationship, oh, you're this or that, and I remember going, no, I'm not. No, that's not who I am. No, I don't have that. You know, and the one trait, by the way, I will own completely is I'm very bossy. Those are my cheekbones. But some of the things I was being called at that time, they weren't true, and I knew that they weren't me because I don't have a trait for it.
Uh-huh.
And that was really helpful to me. to not take someone's opinion of who I was or what they were trying to make me seem like. It's like, no, I'm not like that. That's not me. And so it was really helpful to find that sense of self through knowing my traits and what they meant.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to something you said, because some people have heard this before, and this particular quote you gave, and other people maybe hadn't, and it's really a very powerful quote. So you said something, I think, from Lao Tzu, right, about knowledge and self-knowledge. Could you say that again?
Yeah, to know others is to become wise, and to know yourself is to become enlightened.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, that's a powerful quote.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think so much of what we're talking about in the end is really is guided by that, you know, that idea that you've taken that in and practice it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of my students actually was talking to me one day about how little self-esteem she had and how confidence was a really huge issue, and one of the reasons why is she was doing so much comparing, and comparing yourself to someone else, you know, will make you pretty miserable. You'll always feel like you're deficient in some way, especially if you're looking at some kind of societal standard. And if you understand that, you know, who you are and what you have is exactly what you're supposed to have for this lifetime, you know, for this incarnation, if you believe in that kind of thing. But I certainly do. And I tell people, it's like you have to make peace, you know, with your body, with your personality, with, you know, all your quirks and idiosyncrasies. And, you know, and it's really critical that you get to that place where you do have that self-acceptance, and that is what leads to, I think, the confidence. And that's something I want people to feel more of.
It's so valuable. I mean,
yeah.
You have maybe it's just you, or maybe you've come upon, maybe you've come upon this through your own life journey, but the positive angle that you take has to be so reassuring to people, because, as you said, like, most of us are carrying around, you know, a pretty intense inner critic.
Mm-hmm.
And
if
we kind of expect that we're going to go to somebody who's going to, you know, look at us carefully,
mm-hmm.
you know, like you do or your students do,
mm-hmm.
you know, the possibility of like, oh my God, this is going to blow up, you know, it'll be really
mm-hmm.
awful. And you really reassured people, I think, that you can know someone intimately and deeply and see so much good in them.
Well, I do, and I think there's an important reason for that. I have to say, there's a set of markings that I especially love that I work with a lot, and they're called transformation lines in the forehead. And these transformation lines, sometimes they're just indentations, but they're actually signs that you've gone through a really intense time period, a trauma that's, you know, deep, deep rooted, and it shows that you've come out of it. And, you know, usually they often call the dark night of soul, and I kind of joke about it being 4 to 6 years. It's a lot of nights, not just one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when people have gone through that, it's what makes them more enlightened about themselves. And, you know, whatever happens, it could be all kinds of things. People can die all around you. I mean, it can be, you know, you're caught in some huge crisis, or you can lose all your money, or you can, you know, end up losing a partner, you know, divorce, whatever. It can be all kinds of, you know, traumas,
mm-hmm.
but it's a really long period where life doesn't go well. And when people go through the dark nights of the soul that usually take 4 to 6 years, I call it walking the shadow side of the moon.
Say that again? You call it what?
I call it walking the shadow side of the moon.
Okay.
That's just what I call it. Uh-huh. And when you go through that time period, what you realize is that you just have to endure, and that's when you actually find out the most about yourself, when you're confronted with some really big things in life, and you find out who you are. It's like you find out that you're braver than you thought. You find out that you're, you know, tougher than you thought. I mean, you find out all kinds of things. You're kinder, you know, than you thought. You find out a lot about yourself when these tragedies and traumas occur, and that's actually good for you. And as hard as it is to go through, and some people really have a hard time going through these periods, you can get help. I mean, obviously you can get, you know, therapeutic help, and you can get all kinds of people to help you, but you still have to go through it all by yourself. But I find that it becomes some of the most enlightening experiences you can go through. And one of the things that you learn once you've gone through at least one or two of these is that nothing good lasts forever, but nothing bad lasts forever also. And the nothing bad lasts forever is something that's really important to learn, because the first time you go through a huge, horrific period, you think, oh, my God, I'm going to die, you know, and then you don't. And the next one, you kind of think, oh, I wish I could die, and you don't. And the third time, you kind of go, oh, God, here we go again. And you know, the fourth time, you kind of go, oh, I can do this. You know, but at some point, it just gets easier and easier, and you can stop suffering. And I think that's really an important thing. So I love these transformation lines, because they show that people have done some good work in enduring some hardships that have made them know themselves. And these are people who probably have a better sense of self than anybody else does.
Did you have the perspective you just expressed? How can I ask this? What came first? Your learning about the transformation lines, these life transformation lines, or your understanding or your appreciation that people go through these dark periods?
That's a loaded question.
Yeah,
you
well,
know,
okay.
You can be any age and go through a dark night of the soul, or walking the shadow side of the moon. You can be any age. And I had a period of time, actually relatively young, adolescence actually, and then even into my 20s is another one. I had a series of time periods that were really, really traumatic. And I think I knew about the lines. I knew about them first. I knew that those are transformation lines. You go through a difficult time, and I knew all of that. But then I went through a couple, almost in a row. And then, you know, by the third one, in my late 30s, I was kind of like, okay, I get this now. I really get this. And, you know, I still go through them. I just don't suffer any much anymore. In fact, I guess the strange thing now is that when really difficult things happen, sometimes I just laugh. I just laugh because it's kind of like a cosmic joke to me. Not that I think it's that funny. I just think it's kind of cosmically funny. Anyway, but yeah, I just think that it's one of the most valuable things you can go through, and I think you have to go through it to really get it. I mean, you can tell people a lot of things, you know, about what they're experiencing, but you tell it a lot better if you've been through that kind of thing too.
Yes. I didn't, by asking the question, wasn't trying to...
I know.
Again, I appreciate you're willing to, you know, speak about your experience. But I'm curious about, like, you knew that these lines existed. You've seen them in
mm-hmm.
other people.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what you're saying, this is, again, on the journey of your own inner work.
Right,
that you became, it sounds like you were then able to appreciate even more.
Oh.
When you saw somebody who showed these lines, you understood because you've also walked that walk.
Oh, absolutely. And when someone comes to me and they're in the midst of it, I tell them it doesn't last forever. And I tell them, look, this is what happens. This is what it's about. This is what you're going to learn. I mean, I tell them all of that and hopefully give them some, you know, ability to understand that it won't last forever. I also try to honor people who've gone through it, because if they've gone through something really big, it's like, wow, I mean, look at that. We should all be having, you know, badges, you know, medals for going through all that kind of stuff. And so I think it's really valuable. And the lines are actually kind of like diagonal lines in the forehead. And sometimes they show up more as, like I said, indentations. What they technically do is open up what, you know, the Indians call the third eye.
Uh-huh.
The Chinese call it seat of the stamp, which there's a point called yin tong, which is right between the eyebrows.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's actually designed to make you free the hun spirit, the spirit of the liver. And it's supposed to help you rise above and look down at life from a higher perspective, like you're flying.
Uh-huh.
And so the reason why this point's so important, it's actually a ghost point and a, you know, spirit point. In the Imperial Palace of China, the emperor sat on a dais in the throne room, and this point is also called the stamp point, or the there's a couple other names for that, but the throne, I think it's like the Hall of the Seal, the throne room.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, in that room, the emperor sits on a dais, on a stage, and he's able from that room to look over the wall and see the people down below. And he's supposed to become this benevolent emperor who sees his people from this higher, more evolved place, which is the higher level of liberty, which is human kindness, which is that benevolence. And that's what makes a great leader. And so whenever you have experiences like this, it makes you much more compassionate, it makes you much kinder, because you understand people's suffering. So it's actually a really spiritual marking, and it says that you see the world from a different perspective. So to give you an example, this didn't happen to me, but my sister was mentally ill, and there was a period of time before she was hospitalized and things where she was very involved in drugs. And I have to say, I have a great compassion for people who are addictive as well as mentally ill, because I've had to, you know, be with someone who was going through that. And when I went through my own crises, I wasn't actually going to use drugs, because my body certainly won't accept that. It won't even accept alcohol. But I understood the desire to want to, and that made me so much more compassionate dealing with people who had addictive, addiction problems. And so I think that compassion and human kindness comes from having gone through trauma yourself.
Yes. Yeah. I'm learning, listening to you, that you're, so you have a framework, and the facial reading, facial diagnosis framework is very rich. I mean, we're just touching on the, what we can talk about. We can't even look at it because we're on the audio.
Well, there's so many maps with the face alone,
Right, so we can only do so much on an audio call. But what you bring is the, and I think you said, because you have a kind of a love of people, a love of psychology, you've already integrated like how people move through their lives. Uh-huh. And have the opportunity to face and move through various kinds of challenges, and that you can see that when you're with someone and support them.
Yeah. Well, you can see what people have gone through. And so whenever I see someone who has markings that say, oh, this is a difficult period, I go, wow, you know, you went through a really, really hard time. You know, good for you. And I can even see how much they've learned from that lesson. So, for example, the lines across your forehead, when they're really strong lines that go across the middle, it actually says that you've learned some really important lessons. So actually, I'll go, wow, whatever you learned then was really, really valuable for you. And they almost always know what it is, just like they know what their traumas are, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I hear that, and I can just see how affirming and supportive that is when you're, you know, when you're working with people and helping them to capture aspects of themselves that, you know, might, again, remain hidden otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And face reading is, it's very detailed. I have to say, there's so many things you can read. So in a consultation, for example, you only pick, you know, so many things you can point at. You know, and I certainly try to teach as many details as possible. One of my students said to me every time she comes to a class, she says, I teach something new comes up. But that's because it's so, as you say, rich. It's like it's a mm-hmm. very comprehensive study of human nature, I think, and it's a really fun one.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's easy to see why, for me, it's easy to see why, you know, people found you a compelling messenger. carrier of this wisdom.
Right. Well, yeah. I wanted to highlight something, because I mentioned, you know, addiction and all that a few minutes ago. But I have to say that one of the things that I've learned is some of the potentially most spiritual and creative people I've ever met were formerly addicts of some kind, you know, whether it's alcoholics or, you know, drugs or whatever. So I don't think we should ever look at someone and say, oh, you know, you're this or that, and judge that, because that just may be their process, and they may have to go through a harder dark night of the soul or the shadow side of the moon, you know, less, they're on a different moon, you know. It lasts a long time, you know.
Yeah,
it's like, it's one of those things where I don't really try to examine, you know, how people choose to do their trauma. I just make them aware of what they've learned in their traumas, and I also, you know, kind of want to reward them for having gone through it, because the end result is that you know yourself so much better. Mm-hmm. You really, really know yourself.
Well said. Well said. I think maybe this is a good place to pause, mm-hmm. and I'm going to say pause, because for those people who are interested and find this captivating, well, you should probably tell them the name of your book so people can look for it.
Oh, my book is called Face Reading in Chinese Medicine, and it's actually the second edition now.
Yes, so
it's a hardback.
It's out there, and I know it's available through Amazon and other places, and so I'm saying pause, because if you found it fascinating and this aroused your curiosity listening to Lillian tonight, I invite you to join us at the Building Bridges for TCM conference that the Traditional Chinese Medicine World Foundation is putting on this fall. It's the 14th annual conference. September 14th through the 17th. It's happening at Reston, Virginia, at the Hyatt Regency. The information about the conference is on our website at tcmworld.org. And Lillian is joining us to be a presenter at the conference, which I'm so happy, really, Lillian, that you're coming.
Thank you.
And I'm just one of many who are happy, and we're going to enjoy having more time to hear you speak about your work and spread this really fascinating information about this fascinating practice to the community of people who come to the conference. And the other speakers that we have are like Lillian, deeply passionate about Chinese medicine, about the importance of self-discovery, about recognizing the positives that we can find in each other and how we can find other ways to process and transform ourselves in the face of the challenges that we encounter in our lives. So I want to say to the people who are listening that we have a special offer to you, that if you register for the conference during this early registration period, you can get an additional $30 off your conference registration. And all you need to do is enter this code, very simple, TCM, Tom, Cat, Mary, TCM. Enter that code and you'll be given a $30 discount, but you have to act before May 1st during this early registration period. So we'd love to have you join us and spread the word about the conference, and know that we're going to have many more opportunities to have exchanges like this with Lillian and with other really remarkable speakers who are joining us. And participants are remarkable as well, so I look forward to that. Lillian, I personally want to thank you for making this time available and for sharing personally like you did, and the wisdom you carry as well, and your excitement is so obvious, your passion is right there for everyone, and I just want to thank you for joining us on this call tonight.
Thank you. That was great fun.
Yeah, it was great fun here, too. So I'm going to say goodnight and wish everyone well, and we'll be continuing with other webinars, so pay attention to the tcmworld.org site for information and for the mailings we send out, and hopefully you'll join us for another one, including Christine Page, who will be joining us on May 2nd. So good night, everyone, and take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.